Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, it's time to close out Downton Abbey with its romances and murders and fancy dinners, so we'll talk about that. And in our second segment, we'll broaden out to nostalgia culture generally. Why do period pieces make us long so hard for a past that maybe never was? And what obligations do those pieces have to tell the truth about the way it really was? And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For music games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, right now, check out Ask Me Another. Play along with a Seinfeld-themed version of Taboo, Games of Mysterious Phenomena, and see what you know about some of the lesser-known puppets on Sesame Street. Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We have upstairs and downstairs on this week's show, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Barry Hardiman, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the books editor for Weekend Edition.
And Audie Cornish, what do you do at NPR?
I am a host at All Things Considered.
You are. I have heard you on the radio.
One of many.
I have heard you on the radio. Considering so many things. Considering all the things. So first of all, I am so sorry that I sound a little at times like I need an oil can on my throat. I do have a bit of a cold, but we're going to soldier on.
Does that work?
Yeah, I'm hoping.
Jot that one down.
I'm going to try it later.
We'll learn things in historic Studio 44.
Yeah, we'll see how it works. This coming Sunday, March 6th, PBS will air the last episode of Downton Abbey, which was a huge success for them and for ITV, where it originally aired in the UK. It's been unusual in its reach and its ratings and its pop culture juice, for lack of a less revolting term.
Oil, if you will.
So we're here to see it off. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this show from a pop culture happy hour perspective is that Barry was also with us when we last talked about Downton Abbey, like 3 years ago.
Oh, my God. I was so young.
We were all so
Tell
young.
Me about the skin under my eyes.
Especially your babies were young and, you know, your son was young. And
now they have jobs.
That's right. That's right. So have you stuck with the show?
So I took a break. I feel like I should do a spoiler alert. But the rape of Anna in season whatever that was, I was like, I threw my everything into the air. And I was like, screw that guy.
Right.
He doesn't know what he's doing. This is total BS. And I took a break for...
Are you referring to Julian Fellowes right now?
Yes.
Okay.
That
creator of
Downton
Abbey?
I don't even say thank you. Yeah, I know. Nice. See, you consider all the things. I just consider a couple. There was something deeply offensive to me about that particular storyline. I was just so much a... We've talked about this before, but a rape in place of character. Mm-hmm. And so I stopped for a couple years. And then right before the last season started, I binged on everything else, and which is actually maybe the best way to do it, because then you're just in the world and you, too, have the fringe that clinks.
Yeah.
And you can talk to young women on the train like you are a dowager.
Right.
Countess.
Yeah. I think I may have actually permanently missed a chunk of that in the middle around that same time. Mm-hmm. I was just kind of tuned out of it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I ever went back and caught every single one. How about you, Audie? What's your history?
I think you guys are not the only ones. Season one, people really loved, really got engaged with. And like a lot of British television, I watch a lot of British television, a lot of times they do kind of wrap things up at seasons one, two, three, because all their actors disperse or whatever reason. And this is a show that when you actually dig into it and read a little bit, Fellows talks about how they kind of thought they weren't going to go past season three, and you can feel it, right?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
when, you know, one of the major plot lines is wrapped up, finding an heir, and in this case, through marriage, the oldest daughter marries this Matthew Crawley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it happens in a Christmas episode, and they
fall
in love, and there's snow, it's romantic, and I definitely felt like, unseen, you know? And then they came back for more. And then it was like, oh, why are we here? And I think that's when you felt some plotting that did not feel as engaged as it had been with the period. And those were the things we loved, right? Like, you know, they open the paper in the first episode and it's like they lost an heir in the Titanic.
Right.
And you're like, the Titanic, am I right?
I know
somebody was on the Titanic.
Oh my God, I totally
you know,
know
and
one.
When they turn the home into a hospital, I think during the war, again, I felt sort of engaged with the history. It's not like it's a documentary. I didn't think it was history.
No, but
like, it felt as though it was interacting with its world. And that was something I was really into. And I think the seasons you're talking about felt oddly cloistered. Mm-hmm. It felt like it was inward looking in the family in a way that wasn't productive, in a way that wasn't engaging for the rest of us, unless you were super committed to Anna's latest drama, you know, or whoever.
Joe and his wife, Anna.
Mm-hmm. It didn't tell, that rape didn't tell us anything about how rape was dealt with at the time.
Nope.
Right. And it felt also, I think those seasons just felt very repetitive. They felt like they really didn't know what to do. Glenn, you look like you you agree with
that's
me.
That's exactly
there.
It. One thing remained absolutely true in the first season and in this final season, that in as much as the show becomes the Bates and Anna show, it's dead.
Which is crazy because in season one, Bates was like this mysterious character with a cane.
I rooted for that. I was like a total Bates and Anna shipper. By the end, I was like, oh.
But season three, the end of season three is where it all goes south because, you know, we throw impediments between these two star-crossed lovers.
Yes,
and then we just keep throwing impediments.
Arbitrary ones.
Some more impediments. Yeah. Hey, here's another impediment. Throw it in. Mm-hmm. What happened at the end of season three was, yes, we lost Matthew Crawley. I would argue that's not the thing that did it. We also lost Sybil. I don't think they knew what to do with Sybil. Mm-hmm. But we lost O'Brien. This show needs a villain.
The villain. Mm-hmm.
Without a villain in the house, then all of a sudden, everybody kind of gets chummy together. Mm-hmm. Like when Lady Isabel and Lady Violet are just hanging around being chums, this show does not have any electricity. Yeah. It's like when Tom and Jerry became pals, or like when Itchy and Scratchy are on the porch together as porch pals. It's
and
just you need them to fight.
Like who haven't watched the show, just this character, O'Brien, was a lady's maid for the mother of the house. And right when the whole family's panicking about an heir, the mother of the house gets pregnant. Pregnant. Mm-hmm. O'Brien, through various jealousies of being the servant for whatever reasons, leaves a bar of soap out and the lady of the house slips on it and has a miscarriage.
Yep.
And when I saw that, I was like, PBS is not messing around here.
Yeah.
Like, they are taking babies. This is sad. Like, it's diabolical.
This is like Game of Thrones.
The show felt edgy in a way that really surprised me. I was like, okay, this is how the upstairs-downstairs relationship goes.
Right. Yeah.
And you're right. That was really lost later on.
And O'Brien gave Thomas Barrow the edge. They gave him roundness.
Right.
Their relationship, instead of him just being this, like, sad, sad villain, and then at the end being sad, sad martyr.
Yeah. Also, sad gay villain. I never really was into that kind of old-fashioned
especially
hand.
when there was that moment, I can't remember what season it was, where he sort of defends himself in this very moving way, and then they have him go back, come on, to being evil.
Yeah, how did you feel about evil gay underbutler, Glenn?
Oh, you know, when he was fun, he was fun. Uh-huh. And then when he loses O'Brien, when he loses, like, the person who's more evil than he is, and he has to kind of expand to fill the evil space, he's not up to it. It's just because the character isn't being drawn very
well. And I think ultimately, Fellows felt too sorry for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think because he was interested in exploring what it was like to be a closeted gay man, which is interesting in and of itself, but I think because of his interest in that, he lost interest in building him as a fun villain.
But if you let this all play out too long, then you have nothing to do but to make everybody go through a redemption arc, and then you've got nothing left. You've got nothing left. I mean, do you remember when this show came out, the sensation it became in that first season? Mm-hmm. Because it approached you as if it was homework, as if it was important and serious, and Laura Linney coming on and saying, Mr. Mosley's. And then you realize, oh, it's a soap.
Yeah. It's Dynasty.
Okay, it's basically Dynasty with corsets.
And I think the other thing that I felt at the end of that season three, when you did lose Matthew Crawley, was for a show that is so obsessed with romantic love as the end point for everyone, I don't think it ever found another love story that had the same kind of engine that one did, that had the same kind of burn to it that one did. Mm-hmm. They found other love stories that had other charms to it, right? I think it was very fortunate and very kind of positive that they had love stories that involved older people, not just Carson and Mrs. Hughes, but also this idea that Grandmama also had a past and had her own pain, and someone could come back into her life at some point and, you know, present challenges for her about what to do. I thought that was all wonderful. Isabel has a romantic life, but I think, you know, any soap will tell you need that super couple, you know? And I think once Matthew and Mary were over, I think, you know, for one thing, the balance that they were trying to create with Mary was sort of thrown off so that she was constantly either very, very kind, like she was with Tom, or very, very icy, like she was with practically everybody else.
Edith, oh my gosh, and she went through horrible
these,
with Edith.
And she went through these kind of pointless romances that kind of went nowhere and didn't really
much like
have...
real life.
Yeah,
that's true. It happens.
Fair point. But, you know, toward the end in this season, they matched her up with Matthew Good, who, you know, hey, who doesn't love Matthew Good, right?
Sure.
His last name says it all.
That guy's awesome. That guy's amazing.
Better than good.
That guy... Do I need to leave you alone?
That guy redeemed a very bad romantic comedy with Amy Adams. I love him, but I don't know that they ever... I don't know. The love stories never really had the same appeal to me, and the show is so reliant on romantic love. And without spoiling the finale, romantic love continues to be really the ultimate endpoint of all happiness for everyone, pretty much.
Comedies, yeah.
I don't think it ever found that, like... central couple that people were really invested in the same way as Matthew and Mary.
Although I will say, because we are pointing out all the flaws, of which there are many, one of the things that I liked that it didn't do is it was really unsparing in its portrait of particularly Mary, you know, to the bitter end. And the same thing with, you know, with Carson. They have sort of allowed him to continue to be unpleasant in this way through the last season. I mean, because he was really not, not a fan. And that felt true to them in the way that Thomas's evil didn't, you know, felt like he got, like, as you say, he had his bags packed with all of O'Brien's.
I think we're attracted to the show, or many people who are attracted to these kinds of programs. There is also this thing of looking at class. Mm. And I think for an American audience, it's this idea of like, well, we don't do it like this, you know, those wacky Brits, and like getting to have a peek in on this world. And allegedly, the show was showing us the decay of this aristocracy. But there are times when I can't tell, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in the nostalgia part going forward. At what point are you doing a kind of like real social satire? And at what point are you just like rolling around in the costumes?
You're fetishizing it.
You know, and there were moments there. There's a beautiful moment in this final season where Barrow is looking for work and he has trouble because he's looking to be a butler at other estates. And so many estates are closing and people are bankrupt and all of this kind of landed gentry is dying out. And he happens upon one house where it's basically down to the bare rugs and a few candles, you know? It's just this, like, very elderly aristocrat who's like, we have to keep up standards, even though, like, you know, the house is freezing and there's just, like, stacks of newspapers everywhere. And it's not Grey Gardens, you know? Yeah. It's not, like, romantic wacky. It's like, this is a little bit pitiful. And it showed me something that I hadn't seen before, right? Like, the tiny window into that moment. And I think I like that when there are moments where things are a little bit ugly and a little bit unexpected. And sometimes I wish they had more of those moments and fewer moments where it was just me being like, oh my God, the dress on Mary tonight.
Wish I had a fire in my
bedroom. Headband on Edith. Get it. Yes.
No, I think that's a good point.
Very early on, there's a conversation between Matthew and Robert as they're walking the grounds.
As one is wont to do.
As one is wont to do. And Robert basically says, my job is to keep this place running because I employ a vast swath of this particular county, this particular population. That's something that I just, when if you go into it for the costumes and for the glitz, or the sort of grubby glitz that you see in this particular show, then you're missing all the stuff that's happening underneath the water, right? And I didn't see quite enough of it.
Exactly.
I mean, a lot of the times we get that Robert is working because he's writing a letter. He'll get up from the table and he'll say, I have some letters to write.
Never mind that it's his wife's money he's sitting on.
Yeah.
From the beginning.
You know, on a practical level, there are only so many sets in the house. And this house is huge. And we only see like maybe four rooms.
That's true.
They're pretty good rooms, though.
In the great hall.
One thing that I think is interesting about that is that although I think there are a lot of missed opportunities to demonstrate these class issues, I agree with that. One of the places where I think they do a good job of kind of conveying the capricious nature of the way that life feels to these people is their tendency to have sudden medical things kind of come up. Barry says. And I think that it was a nice meshing of the fact that one of the staples of soaps, and please understand, I don't use that term pejoratively at all. I use it just to define kind of a genre of show. One of the staples of like a soap type show is, you know, somebody suddenly gets sick or injured or dies. And I think that Downton managed to kind of say, and at this time that could happen in different ways you know, the fact that they abruptly lost Matthew was a little different because that was kind of car accident, whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think when Sybil died, mm-hmm. that was sort yeah. of, that really puts you in that mindset of like, oh, life is very fragile for these people, even though they seem so posh and spoiled. Mm-hmm. They still are subject to something like that happening, or as we saw in this final season, a stomach ulcer. Mm-hmm. That was pretty impressive.
That was actually the only time on the show that I was genuinely shocked.
Yeah.
Thought it would be bigger?
Well, no, that it was so bloody that I was just genuinely, I had no idea that was going to happen. It was the only thing you could have surprised me with.
The funny thing about the ulcer, not funny, perhaps.
A couple funny things.
Like, you could tell that it was going to be something, right? Because mm-hmm. they kept doing the, and again, this is a very
soap staple,
where it's kind of where in any movie where you see someone cough at the beginning, you know, they're going to die. Yeah. But you kept seeing him kind of be like, oh, he would kind of put his hand on his belly and kind of, and then he's, I'm fine. And then he would go back and walk around and do whatever he was doing. And you know it's coming.
Because you know Chekhov's gun is in there.
Exactly. Right. You know that he is a little. And he sort of put his hand on his stomach.
Give it credit for this. I mean, this is a huge cast. Yeah. And as we're winding up, you get that sense that everything is winding up. There are scenes in the finale which are maybe 15 seconds long.
Exactly.
It's like, okay, got it. Next.
Bow.
A tidy, tidy little bow. Yeah. A very attractive Victorian lace bow that mm-hmm. just wraps everything up.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Which is kind of wonderful, actually.
It's comforting.
It is like a fire in a bedroom, which is another thing I really learned I wanted from this season, like a controlled fire. I now realize that, of course,
I'm learning a lot right now.
Right, exactly. That not the kind lady you have. But it's really comforting to know, you know, whenever I sat down with this family, that probably everything was going to be all right, unless I
eventually
knew an actor had another job.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's right. And I think, you know, for me, I was surprised to get to the end of the show, which had so many ups and downs and so many people that I kind of had ceased to care about. Sorry, Bates and Anna.
Ooh,
that I got to the end and all of a sudden I was like, just don't hose Edith. Please.
Oh. Yes. No, I felt the same way.
I think they heard, the creators heard all us nerd girls.
They have to have.
I was just like, let her be a mother to her child and get kissed.
Because a lot of places along the way, I think you can be mad at Edith about a lot of things that happen along the way.
Like the way
she handles this whole complication that she gets into when she winds up, you know, having a baby and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. She makes some bad decisions along the way,
that are related to the time, that cause pain to other people.
Sure. But I was really surprised to get to the end and be like, please, just don't torture Edith.
I can't look at that face anymore. I know.
She had a baby? I didn't notice because she never mentioned it.
Right.
Marigold. But what of Marigold?
It was interesting to go back to the beginning and realize that, like, before Mary started, I mean, Mary messed with Edith a little bit, but then I had forgotten that Edith was the one who ratted out Mary about the dead guy in her bed.
Mr. Pamuk.
To the ambassador.
Mm. Mr. Pamuk.
So no wonder Mary is still looking to rat out Edith for various things.
But they know they're both on a soap, so they'll probably get what they deserve.
So there are rumors of a feature film that will, you know, everything's wrapped up already. It's going to wrap it up again. You know, Twin Peaks, Downton Abbey, Fire Walk With Me, so that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So what could happen. I want Isabel and Maggie Smith, the Maggie Smith character, to go off and solve some crimes. Travel the country.
Nice.
Road trip. That's what I want to see.
Yeah. Like
Thelma and Louise.
Totally.
Downton edition.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
I think that would be good.
Do it.
All right. I will be curious to hear how all of you feel about Downton Abbey as it is winding down. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or you can tweet at us at PCHH. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the kind of nostalgia genre that places things in eras in the past and either does or doesn't question those eras and what was going on. So come right back and we're going to talk about that.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Chipotle. For 22 years, Chipotle has been committed to changing the norms of fast food by sourcing and serving real quality ingredients cooked with classic cooking techniques. But real food comes with real challenges. So when it comes to safety, rather than follow the norm, Chipotle's changing it, again. By adopting unprecedented new safety standards designed to put them well beyond current fast food norms. Because they believe when it comes to food, higher norms should be the norm.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about Downton Abbey, and we're going to broaden out a little bit and talk about period pieces and, you know, the way they interact with the eras in which they take place. Now, I'm going to ask Glenn, just because this was your topic suggestion,
sure.
And when that happens, sometimes it's your responsibility to explain it. What provoked your interest in this?
Well, I think if you're an artist today and you are setting your story in the past, you have to kind of reckon with how much do you evoke the past and how much do you vivify it, right? Do you just kind of stay on the surface with the gloves and the hats and the bustles and the morning coats? Or do you actually say, okay, so if any of us were transported back in time, our choices would be limited to various degrees. We would be unhappy. I could pass.
That's true.
I could get away with things. You guys, no way in hell. So that's kind of what I'm trying to figure out here. So you can either directly address it in a way that I have an example of a piece that does directly address it, or you can just be content with staying on that surface. That's why I think historical fiction gets looked down upon, because people perceive that it's about bodice ripping. I mean, it's called a bodice ripper because people think it's all about the clothes, when in fact, you need to kind of vivify it. So, really quickly, the show Gallivant, in its first season, dealt with this D&D fantasy world, right? This fake past of swords and dragons and whatnot. And yet, it allowed two of its characters, two peasants, to actually say, you know, this world is terrible for us, and is it even worth us getting together? And they did it, of course, in song.
If I could share my life with you,
admit it, it would be nice.
We'd share one cot, one chamber pot,
plus trench mouth, tapeworms and lice. We would have a dozen kids,
and maybe one won't die.
And the plague,
the runs,
invading Huns,
just think our time would fly.
There you go. See, you evoke it. You actually bring it into being. By the way, that's Sophie McShera, I think, who plays Daisy on Downton Abbey.
You like the meta conversation.
I wanted to acknowledge that when you go back in the past, it's not all pretty. It's that people have terrible breath, and there's dysentery and typhus, and it would be miserable. For most of the population, it would be a miserable place to be.
And a different kind of racism, and a different kind of sexism,
right.
And a different kind of oppression of various kinds.
I mean, in fairness, I think the shows that are just about the props and costumes don't do that well. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was like Pan Am, and I don't know if there was like a Playboy Mansion.
Playboy Club.
I think even the most average cursory viewer was like, there's nothing here, you know? And I think that's, people obviously have huge ideas about Mad Men and what that show did and didn't do, but I think on a certain level it did engage in some pretty deep ideas, and that's why people were able to stick with it past the costuming, you know, and the like tie-in dress sales at the mall, is because there were some other things going on about like the American identity or manhood or class that you could kind of hold on to.
Yeah, and I think the Playboy Club and Pan Am, if I remember correctly, came out the same season. And I think both were a little bit guilty of trying to do the kind of glam period piece with that the same kind of, we can have fun with all the styles and all that stuff without those ideas that Mad Men at least sometimes had about class. I would say particularly class and gender they were very interested in, less so race and some other stuff, but certainly interested in some things.
I will say, when I thought about this, I thought about the different ways in which TV shows, and I think there's kind of three categories. There is the category of the Downton Abbey, which walks close to fetishizing, right? Which works right for an American audience, because it's not our painful past. If this were the antebellum South, it would never have been popular.
That's a great point.
So there is that kind of show. There is the Mad Men show, which engages deeply with some ideas and is a, you know, a very really, really thoughtful piece that is about literally about showing how we've changed. That was its raison d'etre, right? And then I think there's this other thing that I like, and I sort of hesitate to bring up one of these shows that I'm going to, but the first I love is Deadwood. It makes that time period look as horrifying as it was, but it also it connects it to the future in a way that isn't just about showing you the lessons you're meant to learn. And another thing that's doing that right now in a much more pop way that I think is really interesting, and I have not gotten all the way through it, as I imagine, is the People versus O.J. Simpson.
Oh, no, mm-hmm. I think that's right.
I think is really, really fascinating, because what it is doing is it's showing a time that I had no idea I was old enough to have nostalgia for, A, and it's opening up a world into, you know, Black Lives Matter, the Cosby case. I can't finish an episode without talking about how it resonates. Mm-hmm. And I sort of felt that way about Deadwood, how the sort of American identity resonated with now. But that's not the reason for the show. Mm-hmm. So I like to think of those.
I think that resonance is the raison d'etre, is the point. Because, mm-hmm. okay, take something like Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. which is also set in this fantasy world, mm-hmm. but it's not Lord of the Rings fantasy world. Mm-hmm. It is a place of rank, awful brutality.
Right.
And I hope it's not just about brutality. Because I agree with the Victorians. The Victorians said nostalgia is a disease. It's a trap. Yeah. It will lure you into a very bad place, and it will mm-hmm. keep you there. So when you show us this horrible brutality, we're snapped out of this feeling that everything was great in the past, which is good. But if you're just doing that for brutality's sake, if that's the only thing you're doing, it has to be about us today in some way, right?
Can I jump in here? Because that
Please.
Is actually my huge beef with Game of Thrones
too.
And dragon fantasy, that particular genre, why I'm not into it. And even like Star Wars. There is a certain culture of quote unquote like fantasy stuff that's about looking back to this period that like none of us lived for. Mm-hmm. And what they're really doing is saying like, it was better then.
Yeah.
Like,
yes,
there is this other world yeah. where, like, men were men and ladies were yep. this, and, you know, maybe Sansa would get raped on a wedding night because, and you're like, there's mm-hmm. dragons in the show,
yeah.
dude.
Yeah.
Your idea about there's, like, rules and regulations yeah. about how it would have gone down makes no sense to me because
right.
you've imagined it.
Right.
Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
Absolutely.
People are, in my mind, superimposing some of their own ideas about what is better
mm-hmm.
and hiding behind a history to, like, play that out.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why sometimes, like, I'm not into that genre in particular, because it's always, to me, looking back in a way that is not engaging for me.
No,
you know
sure.
what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, in that scenario.
And I would say, by the way, I think Downton Abbey is an interesting case of what you're talking about, because I gather that in Britain, the show is watched very,
exactly.
very differently. Because class in Britain acts in some ways the way that race does here.
Mm-hmm.
It is a deep wound. It is a psychic wound. It does, I mean, it kind of depends on the eye. And when you're talking about Downton, I think it really resonates.
Yeah. yeah. I got to say, if it comes off as allegory, merely allegory, so then it's just about being overwrought and overdetermined, and it feels like it's this own little world. And I do think Game of Thrones flirts with this. And if you feel that way about Game of Thrones, do not read A Song of Ice and Fire, because it just doubles down.
No, totally.
On all of that
yeah,
stuff.
I went on the wiki.
Yeah.
No, it does. I've read them. It bothers me. Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
I'm an
Can
Outlander
Can I bring
girl.
Up one more thing you yeah. mentioned, which is interesting? There's a difference between nostalgia we actually lived through, like
mm-hmm.
with the O.J. Simpson thing.
Yeah.
Because now I think about that with, like, this is not in the same thing, but, like, Fuller House, the,
yes.
like, Full House. Like,
yeah.
all of a sudden there's 90s nostalgia.
No,
nostalgia is a disease.
I know.
I think that's right. And one of the ones that surprised me the most was when FX started running The Americans, which takes
uh-huh.
place in the 80s, which was mm-hmm. a time that I had kind of never seen that Mad Men style,
right.
Style nostalgia applied
yeah.
to. With, like, the music and things like that. The music kind of treated like it's magical and special and all that stuff. But, yeah, with something like Fuller House, it's not so much that it's set in a period of time. It's that you're instantly – there's no reason to watch it unless you want to be in that period of time, sort of. Like, I should point out, watched Fuller House. So I don't have any, you know. But the idea of it is such a 90s
mm-hmm.
idea. Like, why would you want to do this? Are people nostalgic for that kind of show? I don't know.
Are
I
you
guess
just saying that,
are?
Though, because you lived through that period?
Well, that's the thing. And that's why I think Barry bringing up the People versus O.J. Simpson is so interesting, because I have the same reaction that Barry does, that what's interesting about that show is very much taking it for what it is, but then also realizing that, yes, I lived through it, but living through it at the time was very different from being able to look at it now and realize the repercussions that it was going to have,
mm-hmm.
the echoes of it that you would see even now. And so yes, I lived through it, but there's something to be said for going back and kind of pushing back through that story, because you notice things, you know, that you'd never notice. It's like when you watch a movie for the second time and you notice things that you didn't notice before because now you know what's coming later.
That does not happen with Fuller House, so I'm just going to, spoiler alert, throw that out there to you.
No, I'm guessing it doesn't. Actually, the one that I was thinking about that I think is guilty of some of the stuff that we've been talking about here, less of the book, but I'm more thinking of the TV show, is Little House on the Prairie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right here.
Which I think was a show that really used its setting as a way to just make everybody's life quainter and simpler and to say this was a time when things were really just everybody was better
and were in their place
and was in their place. And the funny thing is, if you had watched the show and then you read the books, the books are much more brutal.
That is about some frontier justice and medicine.
Exactly. The books are much more brutal about some of the realities of that life than the show usually was. Now, the show had its moments where it tried to portray certain things, but
All the Christmas scenes in the books were just incredibly depressing. She got a cornhouse doll, and Mary got a bunch of twigs. It was just like, oh, this is the saddest thing I've ever heard.
Pig bladder. Get to play with the
pig bladder. Pig bladder is the one that all the girls remember. But I will also say, having just gone back to those books and had to peel off quickly my kid, they also turn out to be, like, really racist. Mm-hmm. So that's a real tough one.
But that wasn't coming out of a place of malicious intent.
No, it was the opposite.
Which may or may not matter. But a guy like, a writer like Thomas Nelson Page, who was a writer at the turn of the 20th century, hugely popular writer, lived here in D.C., and he wrote novels from the point of view of slaves, you know, in the antebellum South. Happy slaves and kind masters, because he was pushing an agenda. And that is, again, whenever you're writing about the past, you're commenting on the present.
Exactly.
And whether or not you know it or not, you are pushing some kind of agenda. The very first episode of Mad Men, I think, we see the doctor smoking and shaming Peggy for getting pregnant. Because it's not speaking to that time. It's speaking to us watching it at home.
Yeah. No, totally. Why go back unless you have something to say? You know, I think The Americans is a show about the 80s and spycraft and politics, like, has something to say about the period and is in a way giving us, tweaking us about what we know now. And then flip aside that with another 80s show, which I don't think anybody watched this, but Red Oaks on Amazon, which
I did.
Steven
Soderbergh
show.
It's actually very charming.
Yeah, it's about this, like, teen who works at a country club in the 80s, but it has nothing to say about the period.
Not a thing.
I mean, nothing.
To the point that, like, four or five episodes in, as charming as Richard Kind is, we got bored. Yeah,
totally.
It's true.
Yeah. And I recently watched some of the first episode of HBO's Vinyl, rock show. And I am, like, as I said, I did not finish the pilot, which is the first episode, which I think is 2 hours. I think I watched basically the first hour. I am not really passing judgment on Vinyl. I'm just saying one of the things that caused me to have trouble engaging with it early on was that it seemed to be using its setting, which is largely in, like, the 70s and whatever, as an excuse to make the same kind of show that cable already makes, which is, like, angry dudes yelling at each other, and to sort of say, well, let's go back to a time when the whole world felt like angry dudes yelling at each other. And that's one of the reasons why it didn't grab me the way that some other period pieces sometimes do.
And can I say one thing about, because the ones that we are really holding up as, you know, the Mad Men's and Deadwood and all, in the end, you can't feel like you're there because of the agenda. And what makes, I think, Mad Men in the end, and I really, really, by the way, enjoying American Crime Story, a better series than American Crime Story, is that I was there for the characters. I was there for Don Draper being a fascinating, horrifying fella. I was there for their storylines and the scaffolding upon which, you know, the time period used to build these stories. In the end, I never lost sight of, I really cared about the characters. And when Downton was good, I did care about the characters. Yeah. And I think that with People versus O.J. Simpson sometimes does feel like a cover band, you know what I mean? Because
Cato.
Exactly. Oh, like, man. I can't watch it without Googling.
How do you feel about the effect of the casting in American Crime Story being so kind of aggressively noticeable. Mm-hmm. Like the casting being like, it's John Travolta. It's Ross
the cover band.
From Friends.
That's the cover band. Having. Exactly.
Because
no,
I feel
think that's
like,
it.
I don't know whether you can give people this much credit, but I almost feel like the fact that like John Travolta has a really specific like cultural gravity.
Yeah.
Not in the sense of being grave, but yeah. Like in the gravity sense of gravity. Yeah. Like, and so does like David Schwimmer.
Yeah,
no,
they're
really
heavy.
Specific. Like,
yeah.
That's a really.
You can't hide
and
behind
Ross
your
Geller
eyebrows.
Has,
yeah.
Exactly. I mean, David
as
Schwimmer
Armenian.
Is a.
Right, exactly. Right.
I won't even unpack that one for you.
No. David Schwimmer is a very specific reference almost to drop into something.
Yeah, so there's this other level about the casting, I think, that's giving me that, like, the aria of, like, nostalgia and irony.
And Schwimmer, Schwimmer's big moment was, like, around that time.
Yeah.
You know? So it's kind of like, I'm fascinated by the casting of that and how noticeable it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Cuba Gooding Jr. too is a little bit of a
It's like if they took the girl from Caroline in the City and made her Marcia Clark. You know, it's gonna that same.
It's
but then you'd have to remember Caroline in the City, and I'm gonna just say there might be a bunch of people out there, the young ones who are watching, and maybe they will not be as distracted by that casting as.
Oh, I'm sure that's true.
Would.
There are plenty of people.
It's,
I
it's
hope
for
listening
us
to this show right now who never watched it.
Right,
really true. All right. Well, again, find us on Facebook or tweet at us at PCHH if you want to talk more about nostalgia, the nostalgia genre, as it were. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. HelloFresh sources the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantities needed to eliminate food waste, along with step-by-step recipes for delicious meals designed to take 30 minutes to make. And everything is delivered in a special insulated box for free. Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners can receive $35 off their first week of deliveries. Just visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code HAPPYHOUR on your first purchase.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Audie Cornish, I love to ask you what's making you happy. So what is making you happy this
week? Okay, so this is a follow from last fall when at the time I told everyone to go out and see Spotlight, the movie about the Boston Globe's investigative team into the Catholic sex abuse scandal. And at the time I was like, no one's going to want to see this little movie because it sounds depressing, but now you should go out and see it. Okay, so fast forward to the Oscars when it wins Best Picture, which I think is deserved. And now I feel like I need to see everyone still see this movie, only now it may feel overhyped to you.
Uh-huh.
And you will go to this movie and sit in it and be like, spreadsheets? What is this? And think that it was oversold. It's still a good movie. Just bring, it is a movie about office workers, people. At the end of the day, it's about journalism. And the second thing is just one of those little gifts from Black Twitter, basically, where you're kind of tooling along in the middle of your day and some weird topic starts trending. And this one was trap covers.
Yes, I heard a lot about this.
Okay, so yeah, if everyone's over it by now, but it's still one of the things that made me happy this week. This is people essentially doing like trap music style covers of very cutesy pop. I'm a big fan of covers, but a lot of times covers are made sort of dreary and slow. And the idea is that by stripping away all the gorgeous production that made it awesome, it's now a better song. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I like once I made a whole playlist of covers and then I couldn't listen to it because I was like, this is so dreary and depressing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so the trap covers are people just like in their house making their own versions of, for some of the examples, Adele, Hello.
Hello, it's me.
It's me.
I was wondering if after all these years you'd like me to go over, everything.
Everybody.
They say, hey Jude, Beatles.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take it sense, I'll make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. You can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid. You made out with go and get her. The minute you let her under your skin, you begin to make it better.
Taylor Swift, You Belong to Me.
Understand that you belong with me, you belong with me, you belong with me, wish you would see that you belong with me, cause
so if you want to pretend you are a producer for Fetty Wap instead, and that you decided to do
I pretend that every day
Taylor Swift, You Belong With Me.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Audie Cornish. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Two things. I caught the finale of Gravity Falls, a show I talked about before. Gravity Falls is a cartoon that is about these two kids who go to visit their grunkle, their great uncle, who has a shop of all kinds of paranormal things. It's set in a town where all kinds of weird paranormal things happen. It is very funny, very weird, sweet, but kind of dark occasionally when it needs to be. It's a great show. The other thing is Better Call Saul is back, which is great. And that means that the Better Call Saul Insider podcast is also back. This is comes out the day after the show airs. It's writers, editors, actors, and directors really dissecting the episode, having a very fun sort of roundtable discussion. And yes, as I said before, there is occasionally, like, it's about 30%. Well, let's talk about our wonderful craft service people. They're really great. You know, about 30% that. But 70% really good, solid discussions. Not every show could stand this kind of treatment. You wouldn't do this for every show. But Better Call Saul is the kind of thing that has a lot in there. And even when they start, you know, talking about how great the actors are, there's still something there. And they're smart, funny people. And it's a really good podcast. The Better Call Saul Insider podcast.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon, Barry Hardiman. What is making you happy this week?
Well, it's a thing that has made me happy on the show before, and it makes me happy at your desk, I think, every morning when I come up and I say, are we going to do a pop culture happy hour on Outlander?
That's right. You do ask me
that. I do that almost every time. So here is a thing that happened to me. I logged into my iPad to my, you know, I get Entertainment Weekly on
sure
my iPad.
Do.
And here is the thing. And I know this is a visual thing, but this is what greeted me.
Yes.
Why don't you describe it, Linda?
It's some sexy naked Outlander action.
Yeah,
I mean, wrapped up in sheets. It's pretty hot.
Scotland. There's some loins happening.
There's some loins.
And the reason I want to, so this is a, you know, this is the cover in Entertainment Weekly, but it's actually not coming out. The second season doesn't start until April 9th. But the reason I want to tell everybody now is so that you can start watching it, so that we can talk about it on this show. Because
let's say
that you are a person that is tired of the rape for rape's sake in Game of Thrones. That's not what you're getting in Outlander. You're getting all the good stuff.
We will argue about
that. Okay. Oh, I can't wait. I'll see you back here April 10th.
Exactly.
But, you're getting a real, you're getting a mission statement that is at least, you know, far more feminist and far more interesting and also slightly hilarious. I actually pitched this to a host that was not Audie Cornish the other day.
And I had to say to her,
I literally had to say the words. She said, well, what's it about? After I showed her the cover, which was like, you know, loins pulsating.
Right, sure.
And I said, well, it's about time travel, and there's a World War II nurse that falls through a wormhole and is back in time in a Scottish Highlander
and
lover.
And kilts.
Long hair and, you know. Anyway, but here's the thing. Seriously, guys, stick with it. It is so interesting. There is so much to talk about. I can't say enough about it. And you know what? This is actually one of the best romance series out there. It is really fascinating. It is utterly readable. The summer is coming up. Spring break is coming up. Get on a beach, people. Do it.
So you think I should watch it or you don't think I should watch it?
Seriously, I'm sweating and my heart rate is up.
Speaking of loins, yeah, I think there's,
exactly.
I don't know, there's a lot of action in this room right now.
We all got them.
All right. Thank you very much, Barry Hardiman. Glenn is dying over here. All right. So, making me happy this week, in addition to knowing that I will eventually get over this cold, I'm going to tell you, Pop Culture Happy Hour is going on a little field trip.
Mm-hmm.
We will have more info about this field trip. You are going to get to hear some super awesome stuff that we are very excited about in the next couple few weeks. And on Saturday, March 5th, are you ready? 5 o'clock, happy hour time, in Brooklyn at Lowlands Bar. We are having a Pop Culture Happy Hour meetup. I will be there. Glenn will be there. Steven will be there. And our pal Gene Demby will be there.
Uh-huh.
That is our composition of our field trip.
What?
So if you are interested in that, I encourage you to come and find us at the Lowlands Bar in Brooklyn.
I got a minivan.
At 5.
Hop in, guys.
5 o'clock.
You in?
It's 5-5, right? Because it's 5 on the 5th. Come and find us. You can hang out. You can say hi. So looking forward to that. Come and say hello to us. If I still sound like I do right now, I won't touch you and give you a cold. I promise. You might notice that we are missing our buddy Stephen Thompson. And one of the reasons for that is that Stephen is hard at work and has been hard at work on the Austin 100. I don't know if you've heard him explain what it is.
You probably have.
It is a set of 100 songs that you can download for free and listen to that he picked out with his little hands and little brain. It takes months. It's his biggest project of the year. He loves it. He will really appreciate it. You should download the Austin 100. It's going to be awesome. And so go get it. And it'll make his entire spring worthwhile. Next thing. Glenn was right about American Crime. I'm going to tell you right now. Which, on the one hand, American Crime is amazing. On the other hand, I watched the whole thing in one day this season. Ooh. That's a lot to take in one day. I felt like I got hit by a truck, but in the good way. It's a very, very good show. I enjoyed it a great deal. Also had cause to get caught up recently with Real Housewives of the Potomac, which if you have not tried Real Housewives of the Potomac, it is the first Real Housewives that I have cared about since the Ramona and Bethany New York business. I have been enjoying it very much. And then finally, I have been trying out the Spotify playlist that's called Discover Weekly that is like customized for you that they send you every Monday. And it's creepy. It's a creepy level of algorithmic work. It really kind of makes you feel like they're tapping your brain. They're getting in there. Mine started with a Ben Folds and Nick Hornby song. Yes, there are some of these, which is called From Above, which instantly became a song that I totally love. And then they did a little thing over the course of this playlist where there are like three different covers of You Belong to Me. And I don't know why they did that. I don't listen to that song all the time, but there's three different versions of it, which is a thing I really like, is trying out different versions of. It's crazy. I listened to it. I thought, there's a song on there that I used to listen to many years ago that I haven't listened to in years. And I thought, how did you guys know about that? That's really wrong of you. So it's creepy, but it's cool. So if you have Spotify, try your Discover Weekly, because I really like mine, even though it makes me think they might be like looking through my trash. I'm just saying. So that is all of what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Audie at NPR Audie. And you can follow Barry at B Hardiman. That's B-H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You don't have an underscore, do you, Barry?
I don't.
Nope. Just B Hardiman.
You can just follow. Loud.
Yeah, that's right. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica underscore Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For music games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, right now, check out Ask Me Another. Play along with a Seinfeld-themed version of Taboo, Games of Mysterious Phenomena, and see what you know about some of the lesser-known puppets on Sesame Street. Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.